Welcome to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.
Q is about conversation.
If we're really concerned about ending poverty, we've got to be more concerned about creating justice.
Our cultural products as Christians need to both defy and resonate with the culture.
But God's doing amazing things. His church is expanding. His church is growing.
It's not what's the purpose of my life. It's what is the purpose that's been assigned.
Stay curious. Think well. Advance good. This is Q.
Welcome to Q Ideas. I'm Gabe Lyons. So glad you are joining us this afternoon for another time where we can just think well, stay curious, and advance good together. And as we think about the current moment that we're in, I think today's episode is going to be inspiring to you because it kind of brings us back to our roots. It brings us back to understanding who we've been called to be as Christians. And we're dealing with this topic of the talk you're about to hear and then the interview we're going to have with the one who gives this talk. Of the world is not ours to save. Now, that might sound interesting to you. The world is not ours to save. I think we know that. We know that God's the one that ultimately saves the world. But you'll find in this talk a little bit of a history over the last 50 years where there's been a sort of idea that's sort of crept into the larger culture. It's crept into the church. It's crept into Q. It's crept into most every person in the world right now who's able to spend time and margin on thinking about how can they care for others? How can they solve problems in the world? And it's this idea of activism and progress. And we hear a lot about it in politics. We hear even the word progress thrown around as something that just represents a continued future that gets better and better and better over time. And yet you're going to hear in this talk a challenge to that assumption. Does the world really just get better and better over time? Can we just assume that if we put our hard work and labor and sweat and hours and time and energy and money towards certain causes that they definitely lead to progress? Well, Tyler Wiggs Stevenson is going to challenge us on this. He's the author of the book, The World Is Not Ours to Save. And he actually is going to speak to this as a gentleman who grew up in understanding scripture, appreciating the church, having his own seminary degrees and going on to be a pastor and now as an Anglican priest. But he's going to speak to this issue of how should we think about our role in activism? How should we think about progress? And as he does, I think it's going to encourage some big questions in you. And we'll follow that up where I'm going to interview Tyler here today. And you're going to get to hear for yourself from him some challenging questions about what should this mean for each of us. Let's listen in.
We're asking the question of how to do activism well, because each of us knows the thousand and one different ways we are asked to pitch in our lot for this or that Christian cause with the promise that together we can make a difference. And if this does not get sometimes wearying or numbing, then you are a better soul than I am. In the book, I propose that the way to respond to our situation is by cultivating a sense of the expansiveness of the kingdom of God alongside a sense of the limitations that come with vocation. But I don't want to talk to you about the book. I want to talk with you about how we've arrived at the cultural moment with which it wrestles and what its theological significance is. And 1968 is a good place to start. It was a year that defined a generation. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in April and Bobby Kennedy in June. The war escalated in Vietnam and student riots and activism bubbled up in campuses all over the world, turning into the barricades of Paris. The National Organization of Women had been founded 2 years earlier. The Stonewall riots that would launch the gay rights movement would occur the next year, and the first Earth Day was the year after that. And on Christmas Eve, 1968, the astronauts of Apollo 8 became the first human beings to see the planet Earth as a whole, forever changing our worldview quite literally. And in other words, the late 60s were the occasion for massive cultural upheaval along fault lines that remain readily familiar today. Gender, race, sexuality, class, nationalism, and ecology. But more importantly, after 1968, it became impossible to ignore the power of mass movements to affect human history. And it's not to say that social activism hadn't existed before then, of course, but the 60s mainstreamed it in a way. It mainstreamed movements. In a way, it created the possibility of seeing society, seeing culture as a movement of movements. And that's why 1968 has made activists out of every last one of us, because all of us believe that coordinated action can positively change social systems. In this broad sense of activism, Q itself is an essentially activist community, whether or not you ascribe that label to yourself or not. And here's one way to think about the significance of the change for the church. At the beginning of the 20th century, the evangelist D.L. Moody could famously liken the world to a sinking ship and evangelism its only lifeboat, making social action a waste of time at best and counterproductive at worst. But I would dare say that by the 60s and after the 60s, there was no one who thought that, even if you believed in evangelism with all your heart, nobody thought that it was an adequately loving response to every social ill simply to pursue evangelism. And that's why even as that generation that lived through the 60s lined up on opposite side of that era's battle lines, in terms of method and tactics, they were equally committed to systemic engagement. Jerry Falwell and Tony Campolo, Richard Land and Jim Wallace. Now, the generation that followed them, which includes the average Q participant, carried on this commitment with a generally broader set of concerns. So think of the whole culture mandate that's been articulated by someone like Andy Crouch, incidentally born in 1968. Which has been so important to this community. And the careers of these two generations began to overlap in 1998, which is why for the last 15 years we've seen such an explosion of Christian social activity. And it's also why we've witnessed the gradual shift from an emphasis in politics to culture as the second generation has begun to take up key leadership positions. I'm thinking of people like Michael Lindsay, Sam Rodriguez, Caitlin Beattie. And now we're seeing the precocious front edge of a third generation born after the Cold War, growing up after the Cold War, who've totally internalized this commitment to systemic change, for whom making a difference is as natural as breathing, but we don't know where they're going to turn. And just as my generation grew disillusioned with the political emphasis of our forebears' Christianity, I wouldn't be surprised to see this new generation turn away from this culture-engaging Christianity, but none of us know what's on the other side of that turn. So here's the rub. Here's the moment we find ourselves in. We've got three generations of activist Christians persuaded that coordinated social action can make a difference. What do we do? And my proposal is this, that to do activism well, we have to resist the temptation of a pure futurity, of progress, whether we consider that progress to be conservative or liberal. In 2011, I was in Hiroshima, Japan for the annual commemoration of the bombings that killed more than 100,000 men, women, and children. And as night fell and the crowd dispersed, I was standing on a bridge watching people cast memorial lanterns into one of the city's many rivers. And after a few minutes of standing there, I glanced to my left and I saw a small elderly Japanese man smiling at me. And we swapped hellos. And his English was cautious and my Japanese non-existent. He asked where I was from. I replied and he said, "Oh, that's good. I have relatives in California." And then I asked him if he was from Hiroshima. Yes, he said, from Hiroshima. But because on that day, I couldn't be asking that question without another question behind it, he said, "My parents were killed by the A-bomb I was four." Well, what do you say? If you find yourself standing next to a man orphaned 66 years prior by your father's father's country in a time of war, what do you say, regardless of what you think about the war, of what you think about the bombing, what do you say face to face for a man for whom this is not an iconic image of history, but his parents' rising ashes? And I said the first thing that came to me, I said, "I'm so sorry, totally inadequate." And he smiled and said, "It's okay." And he looked down at this rainbow of flaming lantern snaking through the darkness. And he said, "I come here every year to let their souls go free." I want to suggest that the question of how we do activism well hinges on how our activism encounters moments like this. There's one option that comes readily to mind. You can walk away from this kind of encounter with a redoubled conviction to ensure that such a thing never happens again. You can deploy history's brokenness toward a better future. I see this all the time. It's a very common and understandable reaction to pain. And it's also totally inadequate. Because it's pure future-oriented optimism dishonors the past's irreparability. The cause may succeed, nuclear weapons may be abolished, and the man will still have been made an orphan at the age of four. Well, boo-hoo, some might say. The world's terrible. That's the way of it. What are you going to do? Are you going to let that stop you? You've got to deal with it and move on. But that is not a view of history that the faithful may hold. If we think that we can pour tomorrow's foundation over the broken gravel of yesterday's sins, what we're really saying is that God is not watching, that wrongs need repurposing rather than forgiveness, that life need not be tragic in the end, that history needs fixing rather than redemption, and that we don't need a crucified Messiah so much as we do some good engineers. This painting by Paul Klee inspired Walter Benjamin, the German Jewish philosopher, to write, clay painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned toward the past. And where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed, but a storm is blowing from paradise. It has got caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. And the storm irresistibly propels him into the future, to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. We do activism well by being suspicious of progress's promise, because it will ask us to bury the losers of history in the unmarked mass grave of the past, to justify their sufferings by the work we will someday obtain. But until the Messiah comes again to still our storm, until the angel of history closes his wings, until the dead are raised and what has been smashed is made whole, until then, there is no good we can achieve that another cannot repurpose for evil or undo, which is depressing as all get out. And yet activism based on any other hope is an activism based on false pretenses. We do no labor but that we bend our backs beside weeping ghosts. And when we can stare this fact in the face and still show up, which is to show up without the promise of satisfaction from our labors, then we know that we are showing up to work in love. And then we do activism well.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that talk by Tyler Wiggs Stevenson. And in just a moment, I'm going to get to interview him and ask some follow-up questions about what does this really mean for us. But if you're just joining us, you're listening to Q Ideas, and we're trying to push into big questions around what does it mean for Christians to faithfully engage our culture in the days ahead. Well, Tyler, it's great to have you with us. And in this talk, you really challenge us in this idea of activism and progress, that this notion that if we just keep working for a better future, that one day it will arrive, and that most of American culture's bought into this, most of our generation's bought into this, even those who are part of Q buy into this, and you really challenge that. Talk to me a little bit about why you think it's so important that we challenge that notion, especially right now in a culture that just widely embraces what you're presenting is pretty much a false premise.
Well, I think it's important mostly so that we can stay the course. I'm deeply committed to employing faith and the resources of our faith and for the church's work toward a more just and more peaceful world. I think that's really important. The last thing I want to do is be discouraging anyone from getting out there and trying to do something that will be an act of service and love to their neighbors, improve their neighbors' lives, improve conditions around the world if they have the capacity to act at that level. What I just grew concerned with, though, and my time in Christian activism, where that was primarily what I was doing, was this sense that if we were just about the change that we could affect, that we were going to burn out and that we were fueling ourselves with something that wasn't really true to the vision of Christianity that I see being true, that we're setting out to change the world, we're sort of missing the point.
Right. And I think, I mean, that's what I love about your approach, is you don't mind really taking that whole idea head on. You know, the world is not ours to save. So it kind of says it all in a moment. That's a quite a big countercultural idea. And yet I think what is interesting about this is, like, you see a moment right now where it feels like people are waking up to that a little bit. You know, I mean, a few years back, maybe people were seeing really good progress on things, and it just, you know, sort of that humanistic vision that we as humans are going to make the world better. And yet the last few years, it seems like we're starting to see the fruit of evil, of sin, you know, a word we're not supposed to use much, right, in the public square. But we're seeing, you know, even in American culture, just the understanding that race relationships are not as good as people were thinking they were, you know, or in the Middle East, we see the rise of ISIS and what's taking place as the worst, you know, humanitarian crisis and refugee crisis that the world has known in decades and generations. And yet our activism, you know, isn't solving that problem. And some think that's still the way forward. And I think you're prophetically calling out, like, we've got to work for these things so we don't leave our post. We don't stop moving forward and moving into these really tough conversations and learnings and ways of renewal and reconciling. And yet if we're placing our hope in that as the ultimate solution, we're going to be probably disappointed.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I've been interested to watch and saddened to watch over the last few years as what really I look back at the first decade of the new millennium as one of quite a lot of optimism, at least in the communities that you and I are a part of. I mean, it felt like, you know, there was a new nonprofit starting every other day, with a real sense that, you know, young go-getter Christians were going to fix this thing in no time. And I think you're dead right. Over the last few years, the world seems to have gotten a lot scarier, gotten a lot darker in many ways. And it's hard not to draw comparisons with history and wonder if we're on the cusp of some sort of collapse or calamity at a macro level. I think all the more reason why we have to stay and show up. I mean, mutual friends like the folks at Preemptive Love, I think, really embody this. Doing the work that they do in the Middle East and in Iraq and the neighboring countries of showing up in love, without any pretense that they're going to fix it so well that they can then just walk away and that it won't be an issue anymore. Yeah. So I think that's really going to be the test. And I think the world's presenting Christians with a test right now of, well, you know, it's maybe not getting better. It doesn't look like everything is just improving and everything is on the rise. So are we going to retreat into small little inward looking communities, or are we going to continue to show up in love, in self-sacrificial ways? It'll be the true test of our faith, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point. And part of the hope here in just having this conversation is to help people see that, you know, God's at work in all of these cases, but we have to turn our focus towards our neighbor. It can't just be this internal looking at ourselves, trying to protect ourselves, trying to only do what's good for us. But it's about how do we serve those around us faithfully? And a lot of this is just about faithfulness. And Tyler, I think your own life and kind of your own narrative mirrors a lot of what you're talking about. I mean, you actually led one of the most ambitious projects I've ever been around, called the Two Futures Project, where you were leading not only Christian leaders, faith leaders, but also working in our governments and around the world to focus on the abolition of nuclear weapons. I mean, you can't almost imagine a more ambitious activist kind of vision of trying to help the world see why nuclear weapons are a bad idea, period. You've given a lot of your life to that sort of approach. But over the last couple of years, you've moved into being an Anglican priest, serving locally in a congregation, putting a lot of your attention not necessarily on national activism and how to solve major problems worldwide, but as I understand it, you know, you're getting into the real lives of the people in your community. You're saying, we're also going to be very local. I'm going to be very invested in playing out a way of life that is faithful and produces fruit that maybe is less measurable than your previous career of focusing on this major global initiative. But tell me a little bit about just that personal journey for you and how it's kind of mirrored in exactly what we're discussing.
Well, I think you're right. I'm in some sense talking out of my own journey, and my own walk. It's important to acknowledge, at least for me, before I started the Two Futures Project, or really the Two Futures Project emerged for me as a diversion. I was looking for a pastoral call, and couldn't find one. And, in the time that I was spending looking, the opportunity came to get back into the anti-nuclear world that I had been a part of. And it was in that space that the Two Futures Project developed. But for me personally, that call to the pastorate, that call to congregational ministry, to gospel ministry, was always the first thing. And it was the thing to which I thought I might always return. And so in some sense, this is a returning home for me. I wasn't an Anglican at the time. So I've made a switch within churches. So for me, this journey has been very much an expression of my own sense of vocation. What I don't want to say is you know, yeah, local work is where it's at, and everybody who's working at a global level, you know, ought to just abandon that and pay attention to on the ground stuff. I think that people are called in different directions, and people have different giftedness and need to attend to that. The one thing that I would say within that I've really noticed within myself, and maybe it's a simple matter of getting older, maybe it's an experience of some of the disillusionment and some of the burnout that that I worry about for others, has been an attending to personal sanctification. When I was running the Two Futures Project, I did not give adequate seriousness to prayer, to spiritual disciplines. While I think my heart was in the right place, my faith was in the right place, I think in many respects, my theology was in the right place, I was still relying a great deal on sort of what I was capable of affecting, the kinds of moves that I was capable of making. And more and more, I think that if the change, you know, this is on every college student's dorm wall, right? You know, you be the change you want to be in the world. And I think that can be a little trite and that can be a little too easy. What I do think is critical is that unless we are attending to the process of being formed in the image of Christ in ourselves, that our work is going to be fruitless. So whether that's at the organizational level, if you're, you know, at a giant aid organization or something like that, or you're a local pastor, or you're an accountant, or you're a Christian, you know, whatever, you're a Christian mechanic, or you're living out your vocation somewhere, I think that's absolutely critical.
And I know for you, just recently, even this year, you've made this decision that you were going to limit or completely, I think, get rid of social media in your life and something.
Yeah, I was never on Facebook for the very unreligious reason of the fact that I hate it. but I really do like Twitter. And, but I had this epiphany of that it was stirring up in me anxieties and angers, and consuming time and mental energy and spiritual energy, that was pulling me away from my core priorities. And, I liked it. It's not even to say that it's a bad thing. You know, I'm not down on Twitter. I'm not saying that everyone should drop off Twitter, but I realized that, that these things that were sort of pulling me in all kinds of different directions were operating counter to my attending to prayer, to making that a regular part of my life, and to a sort of spiritual peace, by which I don't mean sort of distance from the world and just turning away from the sufferings of things that are happening, but the kind of frenetic chasing the outrage of the day, it just wasn't doing good things for me. So I've dropped off indefinitely. I haven't canceled my account or anything, and I'm sure I'll be back at some point. But
that many of us have appreciated your personality and the way that you bring it out on Twitter. Always something incredibly honest to say, but also stirring. And yet I think this example is one we all need to hear, that you put it through the lens of first things, and that lens was sanctification, was what is this doing to me? How's this affecting me? How's this changing the person that I am and that God calls me to be? And anything that's coming in the way of that, remove it, get rid of it. Even if it's just for a season, because ultimately we know that that's the first thing. That's the first priority, and God will use that to further shape us. And so I think for those listening, you know, this isn't, as Tyler said, it's not that social media as a medium is completely bad, although we do know that the majority of Americans say social media is making us less social. So it's not necessarily improving relationships. And it does create more of this atmosphere of contention. And I would say Twitter specifically in the last couple of years has moved more that direction, to where it seems that it is chasing the outrage of the day, or chasing the person who said something in a way that we disagree with, or retweeted something that, you know, they might not perfectly agree with it, but was making some statement. And it's just, you know, it's like the crowd just jumps on it. And sometimes it can create an unhealthy environment. So as Christians, we got to ask those questions, like, how do we engage that medium? How do we engage? That's our new public square, or part of it. And so, Tyler, your leadership on that, your example, your model of asking these kind of deep questions is exactly, I think, not only what we need in our generation, but a younger generation is looking for that kind of convicted leadership. Thank you for spending time with us today. Thank you for this talk. Thank you for your book, which I would encourage everybody to get, The World Is Not Ours to Save, because it really speaks at a much deeper level than we were able to get and address today in this episode to exactly how we can think deeply about the role of being active in our world, trying to serve God by being a part of restoration and what he's trying to do in the world, but also retaining this sense of understanding that the hope's not in us, it's in him.
Right. Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the time. Appreciate you, the support you've given to that book and how much Q and that community has meant to me. So it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Tyler. Well, thank you for being a part of another edition of Q Ideas, and I hope you enjoyed this talk. And if you've enjoyed it, we want to invite you to continue these kinds of conversations with a group of leaders and your peers who care about this April 26th through 28th in Nashville when we do our national Q conference. You can learn more about that at qideas.org/2017. And if you've enjoyed listening to this radio show, we'd ask for your support. It's only made possible by people like you who give and support this kind of work going forward. You can support us at qideas.org/giving. And when you do, with a gift of $50 or more, we'll send you a copy of me and David Kinneman's book, Good Faith. So thank you for being a part of this. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. This show is made possible in partnership with Faith Radio and Northwestern Media.
Thank you for listening to the Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thank you for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.